Just going to run this dog to see if we can find any type of human remains that are left.
Listen to Where Secrets Go to Die, The Disappearance of Derek Hennigan. From the Detroit Free Press, a new podcast set in the woods of Michigan's Upper Peninsula. Available on Apple, Spotify, Freep.com, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I know I'm not alone in marveling at the work talented photographers do. The composition, the courage to go after stories, the ability to frame a subject is a skill more than pointing and shooting a camera. This week's guest does it better than most. She's Maddie McGarvey, this week on Story in the Public Square.
When I first saw freelance photographer Maddie McGarvey's work in the New York Times and Washington Post, I was blown away. So was my co-host, Jim Lucas. As we dug deeper into her work covering national elections, women's marches, and other political events, we knew we had to bring her onto the program. So meet Maddie McGarvey, selected in 2015 as one of Magnum's 30 photographers under 30 and named the next year as one of Time's 51 Instagram photographers to follow.
Hello and welcome to Story in the Public Square, where storytelling meets public affairs. I'm Jim Lutis from the Pell Center at Salve Regina University. Alongside me is my friend and co-host G. Wayne Miller of the Providence Journal. Each week, we sit down with storytellers working in any media to talk about the stories shaping American public life. This week, we're joined by Maddie McGarvey, a remarkably talented photographer working out of Columbus, Ohio, whose work has been seen in the New York Times, 538, and on ESPN. Maddie, thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
So when we first came to see your work, we were really blown away by the power of the storytelling that you practice. So just for some background for us and for our audience, tell us a little bit how you were drawn to photography. Were you just drawn to cameras at an early age?
You know, I don't really have a good story where my grandfather handed me a camera.
A Polaroid Land camera, that was it, right?
Yeah, and I just was inspired to be a photographer from a young age. Honestly, I didn't really know what I wanted to do in high school, but I knew I liked taking pictures, and I discovered that, you know, photojournalism is a profession where you get to take pictures of people and tell stories. And so, you know, I just applied to Ohio University, went there for undergrad, and fell in love with it. Fell in love with the idea of capturing these intimate moments and, telling stories that matter.
So after you majored in journalism and photojournalism in college, you interned for a while with the San Francisco Chronicle.
Mm-hmm.
Then you were on the staff of the Burlington Free Press, but eventually you wound up in Ohio, in the
yeah.
Midwest.
Mm-hmm.
What drew you back to the Midwest?
My family is from Ohio. I moved around quite a bit, but for some reason, I'm always drawn back to Ohio. There's just so many different stories to tell. You have these urban areas, you have suburban, you have these rural areas. It's just like the ultimate melting pot of the United States.
And it's the epicenter of American politics on a regular basis.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So at the beginning of your career, were you working in film, or are you schooled almost entirely on digital?
Pretty much entirely on digital. I just missed the film ages, which is probably good because I'm a chronic overshooter. I like to take a lot of photos.
It makes it a lot easier.
Is what this means.
Have you been tempted to dabble in film, or?
Yeah, I do occasionally use film. It's a really good way to slow down and think more about the process and the images you're taking. Especially with iPhones and digital cameras, it's easy just to sort of blow through images without actually thinking about what you're photographing. So film is a good way to kind of slow down and really think about the frame, which I appreciate.
Yeah, let me pick up on this a little bit. So I'm curious, though. So everybody who owns a camera, you know, looks for that perfectly framed photo where you're thinking about, oh, the light and the composition, and but we're hacks and we're wannabes, right? So when you are working an event, for example, particularly in this digital age, you're not just sitting there letting the shutter click again and again and again. Are you actually looking for something that you say, well, that's the shot, that's the moment, and bam, you grab it?
Yeah, I mean, I'm always looking for different things, but it all comes down to, you know, quality of light. That's really important. If there's some beautiful light, or even really subdued cloudy days can produce beautiful photographs. the emotion of what the person is doing. You know, if it's a news event, looking at the context, looking at the surroundings, like how will this one frame tell a story? And so you have to look at every bit of it. You know, what are people in the background doing? What are the people in the foreground doing? What's the emotion? What's the, you know, faces like? And you kind of just build it from there.
Are you ever surprised when you go back and you look at something and there's something that you were focused on in the foreground and there's something surprising going on in the background?
All the time, yeah. Honestly. A lot of times I look back and I'm like, oh, that's nice, actually. Thank you. Happy surprise. But, you know, a lot of it is really a lot of, you know, thinking about every element of the frame and the composition and, you know, how this is going to tell the story in whatever way, whatever assignment you're on to illustrate, you know, the event. So
we're going to get into a whole lot of your work, but some of the events that you cover are also covered by other journalists and photojournalists. Mm-hmm. Do you make a point of, during that coverage, in addition to getting sort of, you know, the money shot, whatever that happens to be thinking about other areas or places or parts of that scene where you could go, maybe not everyone thinks about? And I'll give you an example. Dan Barry, who we've had on the show from the New York Times, did a story on the Kentucky Derby a couple of years ago. And everyone, of course, is covering the Kentucky Derby. He made a point of going off somewhere else on the grounds to interview a jockey. And he talked about that on the show. It's like, I want to go somewhere or do something that not everyone else is doing. Is a very long way of saying, is that also that process in your mind sometimes?
Absolutely. You know, this past year I've covered, you know, the Republican National Convention, the inauguration, the Women's March, and those are all events with an enormous amount of photographers covering, you know, each event. And you feel the need to kind of get the safe shot, you know, the action, whatever's happening. But the ones that I always come back to are when I wasn't quite where the action was. You know, at the RNC, there was, you know, a little boy riding his bike through, you know, a bunch of police officers kind of laughing. And it was sort of like a reflection of what was happening in America a little bit. And, you know, that's sort of like the frame where I'm like, okay, I wasn't where, you know, the police and the protesters were clashing, but it was sort of a different picture of this event. So, yeah, I would say that, you know, at events with so many photographers, it's nice to find something that will surprise you, something that's a little bit different, off the beaten path, but still speaks to the event.
So let's get into some of your photographs. You cover the 2016 election, and one of the photos you took is of a gentleman, and it looks like a child, in a voting booth, voting. Talk about that. Where was that, and how did that come to be, and why that, as opposed to outside the election polling with all the signs and blah, 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 blah.
Yeah, sure, sure. Yeah, I was covering the election for the New York Times in Columbus. It was a day that started at, you know, 5 a.m. with people setting up, you know, the polls outside. And I did kind of get all the, like, standard shots. But this one spoke to me because I think it kind of spoke to the fatigue of this election. I saw this boy with his grandfather voting, and he was just, like, looking so exhausted, and he's, you know, no older than 6 years old. And I think it just really, after this, you know, election where I was in the news constantly, like, it's affecting children too. I like this picture the best, honestly, because from that day, because it's just, I felt that way after covering the election. I think most people felt that way after watching election coverage. So I just thought it was a telling photograph.
So you followed, obviously, the election. You mentioned you also covered the inauguration. And some of that photography that you did wound up in The Undefeated, the online magazine from ESPN. And some of those are pictures of protesters. When you get an assignment like that, do the editors tell you, and these are the kind of stories we want, or do they say, this is the event we want you to cover, and you go out and you find it?
Yeah, so, you know, I think something like a protest or, you know, the inauguration or whatever, you know, it is just an event, and people, I think, seek out photographers, publications seek out photographers for their vision and their viewpoint of it. So, you know, I think there's so much going on, but you just sort of narrow in on what your eye is taking you to, and your editor trusts that you're going to, you know, come up with something original and unique in that situation. So when I was assigned those things, I just sort of went to, you know, where my eye took me, because there's so much going on. It's visual overload. Mm-hmm. but finding those little moments that speak to you and speak to what's happening, reflection of the country. So, yeah, that's kind of the way I approached it.
You travel widely. We've established that. But you always come back to the Midwest. And your photography captures a lot of issues, economic hardship, the opioid crisis, drug abuse, the demise of, the traditional nuclear family. And those are very powerful, powerful photographs. One of them was of a young woman in front of a washing machine. Tell us about that photograph.
Sure.
You don't even need to know what the story was. Looking at that, it draws you in, as does much of your work.
Right. I did this series about, it was actually about style and youth and, kind of youth culture in the Rust Belt, because I think the Rust Belt has sort of this connotation of, being decrepit and Trump country and, coal and everything. And, I just want to show that there's more than that here in the Rust Belt, in Appalachia, in the Midwest. There's vibrancy, there's youth, there's people doing interesting things. So I sought out to do a portrait series of people in the Rust Belt who, are young and doing, progressive things in the States.
You did a series, which is, as I understand it, ongoing, called The Legacy of Daughters, which, as Jim mentioned at the beginning, was one of the things that kind of blew us away. And it really is told through the lens of this young girl, Sonia. And the images are just completely captivating and striking. And there's a whole lot we can talk about here. But start with the genesis of that project. What was the inspiration for that? And how did you find this family, this extended family?
Yeah, so I started this project when I was, a sophomore in college.
Really?
I noticed this trend of grandparents raising their grandchildren. It just seemed to be picking up more with, epidemic drug use and, unfit parents and everything. So I was only about 20 years old, and Sonia was 9, so we were both really young kids still. And, I approached this family, and I just was like, hey, I see this trend happening. Can I follow you? And, it's kind of an odd thing to ask a family to let, a stranger into their most intimate moments, but they were like, sure, yeah, that'd be great. And so I just started this relationship, and it's been 7 years now, and I've just been continuing to follow them. Sonia is now a sophomore in high school. Her family just recently moved from the depths of Appalachia up 3 hours northern to Ohio, kind of to give them more opportunity. And I photographed her first day of high school at the new high school, and we kind of grew up together in a way. She reaches out to me about being photographing her homecomings and stuff, and I'm her personal photographer.
We all should have one of those.
Right. But it's been really rewarding to see her evolve. When she was young, she had a really traumatic childhood. She had post-traumatic stress disorder as a 9-year-old, and she's really thriving now, and it's been really interesting to see that, and I hope to continue documenting her and her family and this overall issue of grandparents raising grandkids, and for as long as they'll let me. So
great work.
Let's take a quick moment for station identification. This is Story in the Public Square, where storytelling meets public affairs. An audio version of this program airs 3 times every weekend on Sirius XM Satellite Radio's popular Politics of the United States. That's the POTUS channel, number 124. I'm Jim Lutis from the Pell Center at Salve Regina University in beautiful Newport, Rhode Island. If you want to connect with me on Twitter, you can find me at JM Lutis. To my right is my friend and co-host, G. Wayne Miller. He's an award-winning journalist with the Providence Journal, who's also recently completed his 17th book. He's on Twitter, too, at G. Wayne Miller, all one word. Our guest this week is a remarkably talented photographer whose work is seen in all the best publications. Maddie McGarvey is on Twitter and Instagram, at Maddie McGarvey. And I'm going to spell that. It's M-A-D-D-I-E-M-C-G-A-R-V-E-Y. Maddie, I want to ask you, Well, actually, we've got a short clip of from The Legacy of Daughters, a documentary that you filmed to accompany the still photography. So let's take a look and a listen at that.
I don't like my mom because when I first was born, about when I was one or two, she called me every name in the book, and she said she didn't even want me. I just hate it when she's here. There was other person that she was with that actually did, like, hit me and stuff, and he almost broke my arm, sprained my leg, well, my ankle. He pushed me down a step, and I went back, and I cracked it, and, like, my leg, it came all the way back over my head. And when he pushed me, I fell. I did a flip, and then I hit my arm on one of the edges there, and I broke it.
So you mentioned that you're going to follow this family for basically as long as they let you. But are there bigger lessons societally that you see from this project? Because there are thousands, if not millions, of families like this across the country, where, as you said, the grandparents have picked up these child care responsibilities for their children who are in some capacity not able. Is this just all part of the opioid epidemic, or are there other factors at play here?
I think there's a lot of factors at play. Recently, I think it's more opioid. I worked on a story last year for the Wall Street Journal about the same kind of thing, kids left behind from the opioid crisis. But it's just a trend that's happening. And, you know, this is one family I've been profiling and following, but I hope that someone else who's in the same situation can kind of see it and be like, I'm not alone in this. And, you know, my family looks like that family. And, you know, that's kind of why I do it. I mean, it's just photographing these people who are living their day-to-day lives, but, you know, it just showcases them. And
it tells their story.
Right, exactly.
Mm-hmm. I'm obsessed with craft. As you have gone through this series, what has the reaction been from the people you photographed seeing the photographs? I mean, everybody's kind of landed on the line there, mm-hmm. if you know what I'm saying.
Right. Yeah, it's funny. I mean, my relationship with this family has really turned personal, honestly. I mean, I've photographed family weddings for them before. I talk to the grandmother, you know, we just sit down and have conversations, and she can kind of let off some steam. And, you know, sometimes I'm just like a big sister to these kids. And, you know, Sonia, like, sometimes posts stuff on her Instagram. I think she really likes me being there to take pictures of her. You know, she's a 15-year-old girl. So,
yeah.
So yeah, I mean, it's really evolved to being like a photographer and a stranger when I started to like growing up in some ways with this family. And it all just came from photojournalism and curiosity, you know, just...
It seems like there'd be a great documentary movie in this at some point too, perhaps.
Yeah.
So maybe we'll look forward to that.
You mentioned Instagram. So you've got 36,500 followers on Instagram. We just mentioned your handle at Maddie McGarvey. Mm-hmm. Is Instagram just, is that where photographers are because it's all about the photography?
I mean, Instagram can be whatever, you know, the individual wants it to be. Some people it's just pictures of their dogs, some people it's food, whatever. But, you know, for me, I like Instagram because it's a place to show my documentary photography where, you know, 36,000 people who don't know anything about an issue or don't know a lot can get an intimate look at what I'm photographing and what's just happening in the Midwest and in Ohio and in the world. So, you know, I've photographed, for example, you know, the opioid crisis, this man who his son died 10 years ago from heroin, and every week he goes and cleans and polishes the gravestone of his son and you know, mows the grass along it. And you know, he invited me to take pictures of him one day, and you know, I did, and you know, posted it on Instagram, and I got a lot of comments from strangers that were just like, you know, my son died from heroin, or I have someone struggling. And it's just, that's a way to reach an audience that I don't think I ever would have been able to reach before. Or, you know, people can see that other people are going through this in similar ways.
You're connecting people,
right?
They're not alone.
Yeah, and I think Instagram is sort of beautiful for that you can really reach such a wide audience, and it kind of puts it right in front of them. People are always scrolling through it, and you know, they can follow who interests them and everything, but they can learn about what's going on. I follow a lot of people who are working all over, and I'm constantly learning and seeing and, you know, getting this firsthand perspective of cultures and communities that I never would have known before. So I think that's why Instagram can be such a beautiful thing for photographers.
So let's move on to some of your other projects. One was domestic violence in the NFL. And again, a series of striking images. Talk about that, the genesis of that, and where that was published.
Sure, yeah, that was a New York Times assignment a few years ago. Brandi Underwood. So, you know, she's a really brave woman. I don't think she has a lot to gain from coming forward with this story, but she came through with it. And with the photograph, you know, she's a strong, like 6 foot tall woman, and my challenge was to keep her dignity intact, and her, you know, people empathize with her but still kind of see the softer side with the portrait. So you know, it was an hour assignment, I think. When I do portraits, I really try to connect with people, make them feel comfortable, ask a lot of questions, you know, relate to them in a way that kind of take their guard down, because inherently not everyone's used to being in front of the camera. I'm certainly not. So, you know, sort of to disarm them a little bit. And, you know, we just connected a lot of things. And, you know, this picture was taken like behind her gym next to a dumpster. You know, there was like, it was like a strip mall, but I wanted to find a way that really just showcased her and, you know, people can view with her and connect with her. So, I think that's that photograph.
You had another picture, another project where you looked at the chemical industry, DuPont and the chemistry of deception. Where did that project come from? Who was it for, and what did you learn?
Yeah, I photographed that for the Intercept, and it was pretty shocking. I mean, I work in West Virginia a lot, and this was all about this company, DuPont. Everyone knows DuPont, and how all these people were getting poisoned in some way or another. And so I photographed many, many people who are having terrible ailments from just drinking the water in the town or working at DuPont. And the man I photographed there, he actually lived, I think, 6 hours away. It was a day where I think I worked 8 hours, drove 6 hours, had an hour portrait with him, and then drove home because it was worth it. I mean, his mom was pregnant when she worked at DuPont, and he was born with facial deformities. And, you know, he was a remarkable man and really positive outlook on life. But it's one of those things where I just thought it was important to this to show these people being affected, honestly. I think that photography can be so powerful because you can read about it, and, you know, the writing can be so powerful. But when you see the picture and their face and, like, you know, what they've been through in life, that's when people, I think, really connect with the story.
And that photograph, again, is really, really striking. And it tells the story of what happened to him, the larger story you were telling, but it also captures his humanity. He's a person.
Right.
I mean, I find myself looking at this, time and time again. I mean, it captures humanity. I mean, is that in your mind too? That it's not like just we're going to get something sensationalistic or whatever.
Absolutely. I mean, when I approach photography and subjects in portraiture, especially, the largest thing I look for is just like, how can I connect with them in an empathetic way? You know, I'm not looking to sensationalize anything. I just want people, the viewers, to look and connect with someone. And so that just talks about, you know, that connection I try to have with everyone I take pictures with if I can. And that might be, let's sit down and talk for 20 minutes before I even take a single frame, just so I can get an idea of you. You can get an idea of me. You're comfortable. This is a, like, you know, short relationship we're having to come up with a product and a result that people are going to relate and be invested in your story and want to hear about you and see you and, like, actually look at you in a human way. And I just think that's important with photography.
Absolutely vital.
You spent some time covering the Trump campaign in 2016, and you've got in your portfolio, you know, a good representation of photographs on the campaign trail. And so one of the, and living in the Midwest as you do, one of the narratives that has emerged about 2016 is that candidate Donald Trump connected with white middle class and lower middle class voters in a way that reflected and resonated their socioeconomic angst. And I'm wondering, you know, you spent time, you lived there, you spent time on the trail, and you spent time documenting these rallies. Does that narrative withstand your scrutiny?
I mean, yeah, photographing, you know, these rallies, I photographed Clinton rallies, Bernie Sanders rallies, you know, a lot of John Kasich when, you know, living in Ohio, and Trump rallies. And it really gave me a better understanding, I think, of the election and what happened. You know, it wasn't, I know there's this big scrutiny of the media among Trump supporters, you know, but, you know, surprisingly, when I was there, everyone treated me pretty nice. They were like really excited to have their picture taken. And I mean, of course, when he went and said, boo the media, they all, you know, turned around and booed us. But, you know, it was one of those things where it's like, I think everyone was just really frustrated and trying to find someone they identified with. So it's still a confusing thing to process, I think. But going to all of those, I mean, just it made some sense. And it was just, you know, Ohio was interesting because all the cities are pretty blue, pretty liberal. But, you know, 10 minutes outside was just every lawn was dotted with the Trump signs. And it was a really interesting place to work during the election.
Yeah, if you just look at those county by county election results, yeah. It's a picture of two different worlds.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
So this year during the Women's March, you went to this small little town, Pikeville, Kentucky. Again, doing what we were talking about earlier, there were marches in all the big cities. You went to this little town. Just very quickly, what drew you there? Why go to this little town in the coal belt?
Okay, about 60 seconds.
Yeah, sure. So, you know, I was working for the New York Times, and they sent 6 photographers all over, but they wanted to cover people in maybe a more red city, red state, who were still trying to make a difference and have their voices heard. And, you know, there was only maybe 70 people at this rally, at this march, but they were working as hard as, you know, anyone in New York or D.C. or L.A. to get their voices heard and their message out there. So I thought it was important to showcase that and say, you know, you're not forgotten. We see you there. So it was pretty special. It was really great.
And again, just visually brilliant.
Maddie McGarvey, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank
Your work
you so
is
much.
Tremendous. We're happy to have you on the show. She's Maddie McGarvey. You can find her on her website or follow her on Instagram or Twitter. That's all the time we have this week, but if you want to know more about Story in the Public Square, you can always catch up with us on Facebook and Twitter, or you can visit pellcenter.org, where you can also find previous episodes. For G. Wayne Miller, I'm Jim Lutis, asking you to join us again next time for more Story in the Public Square.
Just gonna run this dog to see if we can find any type of human remains that are left.
Listen to Where Secrets Go to Die, The Disappearance of Derek Hennigan. From the Detroit Free Press, a new podcast set in the woods of Michigan's Upper Peninsula. Available on Apple, Spotify, Freep.com, or wherever you get your podcasts.